Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for hosting us. Shabbat. We said we would divide our discussions into two things, into general things we'll discuss, and then questions that came in by email, SMS, WhatsApp, whatever. So last time we met, we ended with a question of a parent that was walking up Kiryat Moshe Street, and the three-year-old, whoever it was, ran into the street and almost got killed. And then the parent spent the next 5 minutes yelling at the child so loud that until I got to the door of Machon Meir, I could still hear the mother yelling at the child. And I believe that that yelling wasn't effective. I believe the mother got off her chest what she felt, but I don't think the child deserved that or necessarily got the message the mother wanted the child to get. And so I left you with the question of, what should the mother have done? Meaning you have a three-year-old who just ran into the street and almost got killed and obviously doesn't understand the danger of the street. What are you going to do to make sure the child understands? We have, I don't know, maybe it depends on the stars. Some of our kids think it's very interesting to see what goes into the sockets and others don't. You know, it just depends on the child. But then you have the kid that says, what happens when you put a fork in the socket? Now what are you going to do? So I'm raising the questions. And the reason I'm raising the questions is because one of the things that kept coming up in the questions that people sent in was a question of boundaries and discipline. And people ask the question, but they're not always open to hearing certain answers. So before I bring up any answers, I want to bring up some more questions so that we realize that there's a real issue. Meaning one parent wrote in... how do you ride the wave of boundary pushing? So I told you the first time we met that I'm consulting with my wife. A lot of what I'm saying here, either I learned from my wife or she actually told me. So we both said, wave? It's called the ocean. It's life. When do they ever stop? What does that mean? No, the kids are always going to push boundaries. It's just a question of which boundaries and how they're pushing. Is it more chutzpahdik, less chutzpahdik? Is it more with intent, less with intent? They're always going to push. So you sort of have to... I'm not addressing the question yet. I'm just saying as a thought, when we speak about discipline and boundaries, we have to remember that this is going to be an issue. It's going to be an issue about bedtime. It's going to be an issue about cleaning up the toys. It's going to be an issue about preparing for Shabbos. It's going to be an issue about where they sit around the table. But I sat there last time, and I want to sit there now. And we said we're going to limit our conversation to children until first or second grade, right? Six. That's what we said. What?
Six.
6 years old, we said an age? Not sixth grade.
Okay.
We
no, said age six.
Age six, okay. So I'm just saying, you know, there's a different answer for a different age. But I'm saying this is going to come up all over. It's not going to come up only once. It's going to come up every day, many times a day. And... it's an issue which maybe you expect me to give an answer to. I'm not going to do that as defined as you might like at the first step, but I do want to discuss a few tools that we should have. Number one, whatever your child's going to do, it's not the worst thing. They're still going to do worse. You should never use your last piece of ammunition because there's never something that they've done that they won't do worse. So you always have to remember that there's never a legitimacy to go all out. Because they believe me, as bad as you think it is, there's going to be worse. That's a rule in chinuch, not my rule. I heard it from Rav Yaakov Horowitz maybe 20 years ago. It's a very good rule. Meaning this idea that you got to be prepared. You can never finish your chinuch repertoire. You can never. He was telling me about a parent that beat the child so hard, and he said to the parent, he said. What's going to be when your child does worse? I mean, after you've done that, what else can you do? I mean, you've pulverized the kid. Now what? What happens when they do worse? You've got nothing left to do. So you're never supposed to use your last piece of ammunition in that sense. Meaning, the flip side is, when children have defined boundaries, and children know there's Abba and Ima, and they know what's right and wrong, and I'm supposed to listen to them, and they're in the driver's seat, and not me, then a child has a tremendous confidence. If we talk about building self-confidence of kids, and there are two concepts which we will touch on later tonight, and that is self-confidence and self-worth. And those are two different concepts. When we bring up a child in a pluralistic way, and we give them the feeling that there are many approaches and many things that are right, the child has an inner fear, a lack of an inner compass. One of the things you see in societies which are very defined, and they fight, and it could be when you go to other places, I don't mean to knock Kohav Yaakov, but this is not a nachlut, I'm sorry. This is an extension of Yerushalayim. You go to places where people have one bus a day. You go to places where people don't have a fence and they have Arab neighbors that are trying to kill them. You go to places where people put their lives on the line and they know they're putting their lives on the line, and you talk to their kids and you see a fire in their eyes and you see a self-confidence and you see that kid who was stabbed 3 times and broke the terrorist's knife and continued fighting him. This story happened like 1.5 years ago, right? And he was a kid and he knew what he was doing. And he knew he was being stabbed, and he knew it was a terrorist, and he continued fighting, and he had a very defined purpose in what he was doing. So when children have, the more defined children's purpose is, the more self-confidence they're going to have. Or put it differently, when things are not defined, then children don't have the backbone to stand. And part of being defined is also the idea of, it could be right and wrong, it could be Yiddishkeit being right. It's one of the things that very often the children of Chozrin B'Tshuva are very bothered by, because if their parents keep growing, then a child will very often feel like, well, last year we had a TV at home, and this year we don't. Last year it was okay to watch cartoons, and it was fun, and now this year it isn't. And that's why Chozrin B'Tshuva had to be very careful that their own growth has to be consistent. You cannot keep fluctuating as a parent. Your child must have consistency. And if you want to grow, that's good, but make sure you could hold on to it. And if you're not sure you could hold on to it, then grow slower. Don't grow quickly, because to confuse the child is not fair to them. It cannot be. I had a classmate who married a non-Jewish woman, and I can't blame him, because he told us in class. He said, in our house, 1 year we all watch TV, and the next year my father gets upset and says, not kosher, and takes it out of the house. And then the next year it's back in again, and then the next year it's out again. And we go 1 year in and 1 year out, and we all know it as kids, and that's just the way our house runs. Now his father is a big tzaddik, he really means well, and he keeps having his own fluctuations, but he messed up his kids. Meaning the kids came out completely confused. So I'm not saying you shouldn't grow. Our job in life is to grow. What I am saying is that you can't grow quickly as a parent, and you can't make radical changes once your children are understanding what's going on, and you better hold on to what you grow with. You can't grow at a pace and then take the steps back, which you could do before you were married. And children need the defined terms. A child that knows when they wake up and when they go to sleep, a child that knows this is asur and this is mutar, that's a child that has the basis off of which their own existence is. When a child has no basis, when the more pluralism you give the child, the less self-confidence they're going to have, in the sense that, well, maybe I'm right, maybe the Arabs are right, maybe I don't belong here, maybe I'm taking an easy example. But it's not only in that, it's in many areas of life. If a child grows up, like our neighbor, not here, we once had a neighbor whose father would show up every Shabbos on the motorcycle with a different girlfriend on the back. So the kids saw grandpa and the different girlfriend every Shabbos, or every few Shabbos. So who's grandma? Oh no, grandpa's showing up with his girlfriend. So he was destroying his kids. I understand he wanted a kesher with his father, but the kids grew up knowing there are two options in life. There's what Abba and Imar are teaching us, and then there's the fun grandpa who gives us a totally different life. Now, kids need clarity. And so when we talk about boundaries, we're talking about something which is a gift to the children. It's also a gift to us, because when there are defined boundaries, we can function. If there is no bedtime, then you're going to have a very hard time functioning. And if at mealtime, it's legitimate for everyone to fight, and the parents are just another member of the household, and their opinion doesn't lay down the law at any point, so then mealtime can be really painful. I mean, the kids can spend the meal fighting. So when we speak about boundaries, we have to know that it's not just a luxury, because Otherwise, when we're at the park and the child says, I want to stay another 5 minutes, I want to stay longer, and then we don't enforce it, and then the child ends up destroying our evening. It's not just for us, it's also for the child. When a child grows up and has a clear picture of right and wrong and yes and no, and my parents love me, and my parents are together, my parents are not getting divorced, when these are concepts that a child takes for granted, off of that they start building their own identity and their own self-confidence. When the basic concepts that a child should have are not clear, so that's why we shouldn't introduce our children to what goes on, like, you could have Chaim who has two dads, or Shani who has two moms, or you can have, I get these questions in Mahon Meir, like a person who undergoes a gender change, do they keep mitzvahs like a man or a woman? Why is that occupying them? And if a child is made aware of these things, so then there's nothing that he can have confidence in. One of the challenges that children have when their parents get divorced is, how could you have confidence in the home, in a relationship? Do you trust people? What can you rely on will be there? That's one of the reasons it's not good that children should know what happened to the Fogel family. Children should not be exposed to that. Children should feel like they live in a world where I know when I come home at night, my parents are going to be there. And when I wake up in the morning, they're going to be there. And we should not be telling the kids, you're lucky so-and-so lost their parent, or all these terrible things that happen in the news, they shouldn't hear them. We don't have the news playing in our house. And when there's ever, I said many times, when the second Intifada began, or when there was Operation Cast Lead, I kept saying, don't play the news near your kids. Your kids, they don't have to deal with your worries, and they don't have to deal with the worries of the Medina. They have to have the confidence that life is okay. They're going to go into the bomb shelter when there's a siren. Okay. But you want to give your kids as much as possible a feeling of confidence, and that gives them the ability to develop their own confidence. And that also includes boundaries. That also includes the idea that divorce doesn't belong in a home. The word divorce should never be mentioned in a home. It shouldn't be mentioned in the relationship, and it shouldn't be mentioned in a home. When a person does, they're really doing harm to their children. And it doesn't matter how upset people are. Couples sometimes feel like it's okay to fight in front of the kids, but not to show affection in front of the kids. Well, if all the kids see is the fighting between the parents, then you're shaking their confidence. It's a good idea they should see some affection in front of them, because otherwise, what do they see? Right? That's the famous line, I don't remember who was the Rav, that someone asked him, how could I show affection in front of the kids? It's not tzanuah. And the Rav said, it's more not tzanuah to fight in front of them. Try working on that. So that's it's an important concept. The Gemara brings a story. The Gemara, in the end of Tractate Chagiga, tells us about a family that before the Hashmonaim won the war, so when the Greeks first entered the second Beit HaMikdash, so there was a girl who sided with the Greeks, and she said a line, she kicked them his back, and she said, like the Greeks said, locus, locus, fox, fox, how much money do you take from the Jewish people? You're destroying, you're just consuming their money. And then, after the Hashmonaim took back the Beit HaMikdash, so Beit Bilga, that was the name of the family, that family was taxed, that everyone else had a cubby, their cubby was locked. Everyone else had a ring, which they could take control of the animals when they were responsible for them, their ring was locked. They always had to go begging from other families of Kohanim. They said they were like half a boot outside the camp. So the Gemara says, but it was one girl. Why'd they tax the whole family of Kohanim? You're talking about 6% of all the Kohanim were taxed with this tax. So the Gemara says, Shuta de Yanuka. What you hear a child talking is what they heard at home. So we have to choose our words at home. I want to deal now we'll deal with the concept at large and then applications to some of the questions that came in. If we pay attention to what words we use at home, And then we'll see the kids using those words too. Now that involves words and attitudes. And one person wrote in a question, what do I think of the schools in Kochav Yaakov? So that's a very touchy question. I think the schools in Kochav Yaakov are great. I think that every school is great for the right student. You have to know what you want to get out of the education, and you have to know what you want your child to get. You're asking me objectively, how are the schools in Kochav Yaakov? I think they're very, very good. The boys' school is really, really good. And the girls' school, we know there are challenges there that need improvement. And it's a good question. Meaning the girls' school has improved drastically over the last 7 years. It's a very good school compared to what it was. The question is, the challenges the girls' school is facing today, you have to be aware of if you're sending a girl there. It keeps going in the right direction. That's also a positive thing. Now, is it right for your child? Well, that depends on who you are. That depends on what you want to get out of the education. Objectively, is it a good school? Yeah, it's a good school. If a child comes home and all they hear from the parent is how lousy their school is, or how it doesn't compare to where the parents studied, or when we were a kid, we heard that. Don't expect the kid to see the school positively. Now, every school you send your child to, you're going to have issues with. The question is, which issues? So one school is going to tell your child to make a bor priyat on a banana, and another school is going to tell your child that you're not allowed to watch movies, you're only allowed to watch hakranot. What's the difference? If we show it to you, it's called hakrana. If they show it to you, it's called a movie. Children aren't stupid. Every school is going to have these very interesting things that they tell you. I have a friend 30 years ago. The school told his daughter, it's not tsanua for girls to ride bikes. So he went to Rav Moshe Feinstein and asked him, can a girl ride a bike? He said, yeah, it's okay. Now the Beis Yaakov in America had a big problem. Rav Moshe just said, there's no problem for a girl to ride a bike. Now what are you going to do? They didn't back down. So how do you deal? Rav Moshe said, it's okay. The Beis Yaakov said, it's not okay. Your daughter knows you went to Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe said it's okay, and she knows the Beis Yaakov heard that. Well, why'd she know all that? Maybe she wasn't supposed to be given all that information. As a parent, we have to think about what we're saying at home. And what's right or wrong is not the only question we should think about. We have to think about, what is our child hearing? So I'm going to start a sentence, and you think what comes to mind. Don't say it, please. Okay? My husband... Or you can say something positive or negative. Ask yourself that. Well, what's your child hearing? When you're on the phone and what you're saying is, my husband, are you more often saying positive things or negative things? Things that annoy you or things that make you happy? What is your child hearing? Your child will mimic you. Watch them play house. So we have to pay attention to the words, the tones of voice, the attitudes we use. And that affects the children. People are sometimes upset. Why are my children negative? A parent called me up and said, my child is always negative and sarcastic, and I didn't know how to tell the parent, well, so are you. Your child is just mimicking the same style you have. What do you want me to say? You know, if that's what they hear all the time, so that's sort of what they think they're supposed to do. So I said it nicely and gently, and I said, you know, the same thing I'm saying here, without saying it directly. But the real answer, I think, to that parent is they're just mimicking what they see at home. So yeah, so they're sarcastic and they're negative, and that's okay. They're just mimicking what they see. The second thing we should discuss is a very powerful tool which works for all ages. Works for adults too. And it's the story. Story. Stories are probably the most powerful tool you have as an educator. More powerful than almost any other tool you have. We had a student who came to Machon Meir. He had a very complicated form of Crohn's disease. He had parts of his intestines cut out. He came to class with a bag. He showed up to Machon Meir with complications. He was by us for 3 weeks. And the complications reached a point that he needed emergency surgery. His father married a woman who was a born-again Christian, and she believed that her only salvation came from convincing Jews to believe in Oto Ha'ish. So this was the home he had left. His father had decided that to keep his marriage, saying he was going to turn a blind eye to all this, and he felt he can't do that, so he came to us. 3 weeks after he was biased, he needed emergency surgery, and the hospitals in Israel wouldn't deal with him. And it became clear that within a day or two, he would have to fly back to the United States, and we might never see him again. And he would have to be in that house with that woman, and possibly incapacitated. So I had to give a class that he could take with him. Right? What do you tell a guy who has a really serious condition, who is about to go into a home where he's not allowed to say a word against the missionary who believes their whole purpose is going to be to convert this guy to Christianity? So I told him the following story. I did not speak to him. I spoke to the class. And as I was talking to the class, whatever the subject was, it was probably something in the Chafetz Chaim we were learning, I weaseled in a story which was really aimed at him, but he didn't know I was talking to him. So I told them the following story. Down the road from Machon Meir, there was a family where the mother had leiomyosarcoma, which is a form of cancer which is not curable today yet. And they knew that she had 1 year left to live. And slowly but surely, she was going down the path. And things became worse. And it reached a point where she couldn't walk on her bad leg. So when she entered the hospital and she started getting treatment, she decided, the medicinal clown came to visit them. And she watched his act. And then she said, this would be a little bit better if you do this one, this would be a little better if you do that, but why don't I show you? And she went with him to the next patient and worked with him. And then the next patient. And then this became a routine. While she was waiting for treatment, she'd go with the medicinal clown and make other patients happy. She reached a point where she couldn't walk anymore. So she got a scooter, put her bad leg on the scooter, and went with him wherever he went to make the other patients happy. And at one point, she was standing with him trying to talk to another oncology patient whose condition was not so bad. And the patient looks at them and he's not willing to budge. And finally he says to them, "You guys can be funny, you guys can make jokes, you're both healthy, but I'm stuck in this bed." And the clown looks at her and she looks at the clown and they both, they move on. And almost until the day she died, she spent her time in the hospital while she was waiting for her appointment, making other patients happy. And her life was, I can tell you her name, Sarah Brace. She spent the last period of her life. I mean, I remember when she was by our house, about 2 months before she passed away, she said to my wife, "My little daughter is not yet toilet trained. Before I die, I have to toilet train her. I can't leave my husband in Alman with a 2-year-old not toilet trained." So, and she did. She toilet trained the kid. So I said the story and I said, there are people, I was once accompanying them to a doctor's visit, which was their final doctor's visit, but at the time we didn't know it, and they drove into Tel Aviv. I got so sick in the car that they had to stop along the side for me to throw up on the side of the road a few times. And when I thought to myself, I'm gonna come to the doctor and I'm gonna be able to talk to him. When we left the doctor, it was in Tel Aviv, so she asked her husband, "How far are we from the sea, from the Yam?" So he says, "We can drive by there." And I said, I hate to spoil your ride, but I'm like throwing up every 2 minutes. If you don't mind, I'd rather we take the short route home. I was doing them a favor, I was coming along to help them. So she said, "Fine." And then he asked her, "Why do you want to go see the sea?" And she says, "I just figured I'd get in one more bracha." I felt like 2 cents, right? it wasn't like I thought she wants to stroll by the sea. I said, I'm a person too. She wanted to get in a bracha. She wanted to get in one more bracha. So that's the person. So I said, there are people that even in the face of death, even where she knew she was leaving 4 or 5 yesomim, where the eldest was just 12 or 13, and the youngest was 2 and not toilet trained, she spent her difficult hours being positive and being a source of positivity to everyone around her. People she didn't know, everyone she knew. She was in pain, but she said, I have to be positive in spite of what I'm going through. And I'm giving this as an example for something, not even looking at this guy, telling the story, and my goal is to talk to him, because I know that he's about to enter something which we don't know if he'll ever get out of. And we leave class, and then I have my parting meeting with him. And then he goes to me, you know, that story really spoke to me. I go, which story? I'm playing it dumb. So he goes, that lady, I think that's going to be my role model. I said, oh, that? He goes, yeah, that was amazing. That's what I have to do. Even though I'm going to be, and he's playing out to me everything I tried to say without saying it to him, he's walking, coming back and telling me, yeah, that's what I have to do. Right, that was the point. Now, if I would have given a Musar Shmuz and stood up there and said to him, you know, you have to be positive, you can't let the downs get you down. If I would have started telling him all the messages I wanted him to get, I would have gotten nowhere. That's nice, Rabbi. What do you know what I'm going through? You tell a story. That was our parting conversation. Never spoke to him again. It's been a decade. I have no idea what ever happened to him. I tried contacting him. I don't know. But I know that my final punch, what I tried to accomplish, was a story. And I know that he got the message, whether he was able to implement it in his life or not. Life is a challenge. We don't. That's a good question. Many of the chinuch challenges we face, we can define the issue. Now, how do we overcome it? Very often, you can resolve stories without tackling them directly, but rather through a story. So let's take a few examples. Your child is scared of going to sleep at night. They're scared, they're telling you maybe mechablim will come in, you have to lock the front door. I'll just touch on another point before we get back to this example. Kids connect to physical things, so do adults. When people leave the mahon, I very often give them a half a shekel. And I tell them, hold on to this, this is something from me, so you'll have it with you. Students sometimes come back a decade later and they show me in their wallet, I still have your half shekel. I tell them, I want to be with you. I can't be with you your whole life, right? But something from me will be with you. Take it. And students hold on to it. The idea behind it is something physical. Very often when a child goes into surgery or something like that, I've sometimes given a student my talis, my tzitzis, a half a shekel. Doesn't matter what. You give someone something physical, you've given them something to hold on to. When my kids get up and say they're scared, they had a bad dream, or they can't sleep at night. So I used to give them the hadassim, because the hadassim from Yerba Minim, it says, there's Kabbalistic sources, the Teimanim quote, that your hadassim protect you from bad dreams. So I wrap up my hadassim every year, I become like a Hasidic Rebbe, and the kids can each get a hadass to put under their pillow. But what happens when they wilt, or when they get lost? So one night, one of the kids gets up all upset, and they're having bad dreams, and Abba, where are your hadassim? So I go looking, they're gone. So what am I supposed to do? So I sat there thinking. I went and I grabbed the psamim from Abdullah, and I said, this works too. And ever since then, our psamim at home, any kid that has trouble going to sleep takes the psamim, puts it under their pillow, and you know what, it works. Okay, so I'm saying when you can hold on to something, very often that's very empowering. And now that could also be a child going to school on their first day. You can create sgulot. Don't tell them it says in the Gemara, but you can create it. I had a child that was upset every day they went into school. We developed a ritual. I'd walk them to the front door, take out a piece of paper, usually the Kabbalah from the bus, draw a happy face with them, discuss with them, are you going to be happy inside? They'd say yes. Fold up the paper, they put it in their pocket, they went in, now they were okay. They had the smiley face from Abba. They held on to something. It was something they put in their pocket. We drew it together. Sometimes they drew it, sometimes I drew it. But they had something physical, tangible. Very often it gives a child much more strength. A child went into surgery, I said to him, I'm giving you half a shekel. Anytime you're scared, we're going to ask them if you could have it in your pocket. You could feel it. And the child comes out and says to me, sure, you know how many times my whole waking hours, I was clutching onto that half a shekel. Half a shekel is just because it's cheap. But it's also because there's an idea of machtzis a shekel. We're all part of a greater whole. And it's a nice big coin. I try to get shiny ones. By the way, when you get change from stuff, you're going to start using this, try to get shiny ones. People are happier with a shinier thing. So coming back to the story, So we have to know a rule. It says in the Rebbe of Piasechna in Chovat HaTalmidim, when you tell a child a story, they ask you the weirdest details and you have to answer them because they're a child, it's real. So let's say your child is scared of going to bed at night and you want to tell them a story about a child that was also scared of going to bed at night. So you're going to start the story and your kid is going to say, what was the child's name? And you're going to say, what does it matter? Oh, you have to give him a name. Don't say what does it matter. To your child, the details matters. That means you have to tell him. You have to preclude the situation. That means you tell him there was a little boy. His name was Chaim. He was 5 years old. He had red hair. And his Abba and Ima lived in a town just like Kochav Yaakov. And if he tells you, well, what was the name of the town? You got to give him a name. And if he asks you, where did they live? You have to give him a street. And don't think, hey, my kid is driving me crazy. Your kid is being normal. Again, in the Chovat HaTalmidim, the Rebbe of Piasechna in his introduction writes, you should know that children see a story in all its details. You tell him about a car, he's going to ask you which car and what color, and you have to answer that. And if you get used to it, so you'll address that already so the child won't have to ask it. So you're telling the child a story. Okay, so Chaim used to be scared of going to bed. You might want to, through the story, understand your child better. And that's where it's helpful to say to the child, what do you think Chaim is scared of? And then you might get to hear from your kid what he's scared of. And it's less threatening because it's not about him. And then you say, okay, so Chaim was scared because his room was dark. Chaim was scared because every time he heard noises, he thought something else was happening. Chaim was scared. And then Abba and Ima said to Chaim, you know, you're already becoming six. So now is an age where you don't have to be scared. You can try to lie down alone for 2 minutes and see if you're not scared. And at first, Chaim was very hesitant. And then Ima said, you know what? I'll sit with you for the first 10 seconds. We're going to count till 10. And then I'm going to go and prepare myself something to drink and come back in 2 minutes. And you're going to see if you were okay. And Chaim said, okay, I can do that. So Ima sat with him and they counted till 10. And then she went out. And Chaim lay there and said, am I really scared? And he said, I'm not so scared. The noises I hear aren't scary. Ima's coming back in 2 minutes. That's not so long. And so Chaim lay there and started thinking happy things. And he discovered that when he thinks about happy things, he doesn't even notice all the noises. Notice how you're creating for the child answers to their questions. You're giving them tools. Sometimes you, in the story, you have to prepare. I will sometimes sit and think for 15 minutes before Shabbos about which story I want to tell the kids because there's a point I want to accomplish with the story. And if you're going to think it through, you can give the kids the tools to deal with things. Now, that includes many areas. Let's say you have a kid that's always getting into fights. You have a kid that doesn't know how to share, or a kid that doesn't know how to make friends and gets into complicated situations with other children. So then you can start telling him stories about a child. Now, here it breaks down. Some kids love stories about themselves. Our kids are, if you tell them that the child's name is their name, they're very happy with that. Then the story is great. You won't always be able to get in the educational things you want to because there are certain things they're not willing to say about themselves. So sometimes it's good to tell them stories that are very foreign from themselves so they won't even get that you're talking about them. I told my kids that I almost beat a kid up yesterday. So all the kids were shocked. What happened? Why would you almost beat up a kid? They said, I got onto the bus was packed, and this kid was sitting in the front seat, and an old man, 70 or 80 years old, got on, and the bus started going, and you could see that the old man could hardly hold on. So I turned to the kid, and I said to the kid, you know, there's an old man standing there. Now, the kid was 13 years old. He wasn't like a little kid, 13 years old, sitting next to his father who fell asleep, and the kid looks at me and says, yeah, shrugs, and looks away. So I'm standing there thinking, what did you just do? What did you come to the kotel for? You're going to let an old man fall on the bus because, yeah, who cares? So I said to my kids, I had to restrain myself. I'm like, hitting the kid, what are you doing? And his father's sleeping, what am I supposed to do? So now, I didn't tell the kids they should get up and give their seat to an old man. I didn't speak to them anything about them. But they never heard me say I almost hit someone else's kid. So when they heard how upset I was yesterday seeing this kid, a message went in. They got the message. It is very indecent to do what that kid did. End of story. The message is home. I move on, they move on, but the message is there. Hopefully they didn't need it, but it's done. One story, they got the message. Stories are very, very important. You want to understand how your kids are getting along or not getting along or why they're not getting along, try to develop a story with them. Very often kids don't have the social tools to play with other children. So you can ask a child a question. Which children do you like playing with? Why do you like playing with them? What do you think you can do so that other children will like to play with you? Now, of course, this has to be done in a semi-sterile setting. If you're doing it where all the other kids are clambering around playing games and he's really not interested in this conversation, you're not going to get anywhere. There are times where I'll take my kids for a walk because I know that in the house there's no way I'm going to have a natural conversation with them. I could call them into a side room, but now it becomes real serious. Why would Abba call me into a room? So that's not good either. That's not the environment you want. But if you say, I'm going up to the Makot, you want to come walk with me? So the kid says, yeah. And then you go for a walk. And as you're walking, you start talking and you get places. So you have to decide the setting. It's not just about the story. It's also the setting. But stories are maybe the most powerful tool you have as a parent. One of the most powerful tools to get points across to your kids and to help your kids work out things. So let's say your child is what we find very often with first children. They don't know how to fight for anything because they don't have to fight for anything. Your eldest child is usually the child who grows up alone. They're an only child, right? So then they show up to Gan and suddenly they discover there exists this concept as the other child took something that's mine. So what does the eldest child usually do? They stand and they look at it dumbfounded and they're not sure what to do. They'll cry. They're not sure what they're supposed to do now because it's not a scenario they've dealt with. Usually the second child already, he's born into a scenario where there are other children there. But the first child is a different existence. Parents very often mislead themselves into thinking that their second child is going to be as docile as their first child. They compliment themselves, saying, oh, I can do this. I don't know why other parents are having challenges. That's because the first child is very often, they have no other gauge other than the parent. It's always easier to deal with your first. Then when the second shows up on the scene, then things become more interesting. How do you help your child deal with it? So you ask them, what happened? They took my toy. And what do you want should happen? That's an important question. Even as adults, we don't always ask that question. What do we want? And in an ideal world, what would I want? People don't ask that. It's an important question. So the child says, I want them to give it back. And then comes the question, well, you don't want them ever to play with that toy? No, I want them to play with it when I'm not playing with it. But what if they want it now? But I want it now. Okay, so what do you want should happen? I want them to wait. How long do you want them to wait? Do you think it's fair that they should always wait? How many of that toy do we have? And if we start discussing it, that's one route. What if we tell a story? I can accomplish everything I would do in the discussion, but better in a story. Because I could say, you know, Chaim came to Gan. There was only one bimba. He took the bimba. Shmuley wanted the bimba. Chaim initially thought, I'm not going to give it to him. I want to ride on the bimba. Then Chaim thought to himself, it would be really nice if I would give it to him. Then he would also play and he'll be happy too. I don't have to fight him over it. So Chaim said to Shmuley, you know, why don't you give me one more minute and then I'll give you the toy. By the way, that one more minute makes a world of a difference. That one more minute gives the child the feeling of I'm in control. If you give something away the first second someone asks you, you're not in control. If you tell someone just a second, that's part of what your kids are doing to you when you ask them for something and they say, just a minute, Mom. They're taking control of the situation. You notice how that happens? Then they forget you exist. That's real. They forgot. But the first second they said 1 minute, that's they're holding on to their identity. If I stop what I'm doing the second someone else told me to do something, I lose my identity. I'm someone's servant. If I had the choice to say just a second, I count till three and then I'll give it to you, then I've retained my own, I exist, that's my decision. When I want it, I gave it, not the second you asked for it. That's a good thing to do with kids also. If one kid wants a toy and the other kid's playing with it, it's good to say to the child who's giving up on the toy, when do you want to give up on the toy? If you've decided that they have to share that toy, it's much better to ask the child, do you want for 1 minute, 2 minutes, half minute? Sometimes kids have no concept of time. You can take advantage of that, right? Okay, you're going to have it for 5 more minutes, and then you get, oh, your 5 minutes are up. Okay, okay, don't make it 2 seconds, but I'm saying a child doesn't know the difference between 1 minute and 5 minutes. I want it for five. Okay, have it for five. And then whenever you think the 5 minutes are up, they're up. Okay, so stories are a very powerful tool to helping our children deal with things. Your child's going to their first day in school. You tell them a story about another child that went for their first day in school. You can deal with a lot. You can talk about the excitement instead of the anxiety. One of the things that happens in a story is that you control the emotions of the child. If you tell the child, again, the first day of school is coming, he couldn't sleep at night. He was getting up, he was having cold sweats, he found himself down that night. You destroyed the kid. Tell a different story. He knew there was first day of school and it was going to be a lot of fun. There were going to be other children there. He was so excited. He got up early the morning of the first day of school. He asked his Zina the night before, can you prepare my clothing? I want to wear the nicest clothing. I'm going the first day. I want to be there on time. He was so excited. He was going to play with new children. You can create emotions in the child. You're not forcing them those emotions. You're teaching them a different attitude, a different approach. And you can also create different outcomes. If your child keeps repeating the same behavior, then you can speak about a child that changed the behavior. So stories can be used, but stories have to be used with skill. Okay, you have to tell me if we're going to take the next 10 minutes to talk about more about stories or move on. I think it's an important tool. I think that people have to learn how to do it. What's the vote?
A question.
Could ask many. Yeah.
When you said that a child, when they say, just a minute, and they're taking control back, are you supposed to say, no, go do it now, and take the control back then, or say, okay, fine, you know, or not even say anything, but, you know, okay, fine, one more minute, and then follow up with that a minute later?
Okay.
Because very often you tell them to do something, they are really in exactly in the middle of playing this game or whatever, and someone did that to me, I would want to, okay, give me a minute, finish up what I'm doing, and then I can go do it.
I don't think there's a right answer. I think there are a few different things we should take into account, which I was going to deal with, pertaining to one of the questions. So maybe I'll just quote the question then, and then I'll try to see if I can find it. So someone asked the following question, what are the steps you take when your child is not listening? So we could have a series on that. I'm saying that's a... but let's take your example, maybe within that. Okay, so I'd rather deal with it within that question, okay? So child's not listening. It depends on the age. Very often, especially when it's your first or second kid, you don't really understand what's age appropriate. So let's take a classical example. Parent asks their child to clean up the room. Until a child's about 11, I'm not sure they can do that. If you tell a child, can you clean up the Lego? They can do that. If you told the child this amorphous term, just clean up your room, they have no concept of what that means. You just told them something very complex. And by the way, the same is true of your husbands, okay? Gotta be very specific. Tell them specifically, I want you to clean up the Lego. And then tell them, I want you to clean up the floor. Or better, tell them, I'm gonna come back to the room in 3 minutes. I wanna see no clothing on the floor. Take care of all the clothing on the floor. If we give specific instructions, they can handle. And again, 11 is not so clear. Meaning, depends on the child. Most children, you try giving them a broad description, clean up the living room, you know, they're gonna clean up three things and wonder, what do you want, I clean. So then you're gonna start pointing and saying, but what about, okay, I'll deal with that. But the parent here was in the wrong, not the child. Tell the child, I want you to clean up the Lego and the kapla and the blocks. And come back to me in 5 minutes after you clean that up. If you didn't give specific instructions, then don't fault the child. Now, so you said something and the child didn't do it. So you asked the child, can you clean up the Lego? And you did it right. You said, can you please clean up the Lego? By the way, this is one of the differences between men and women. Women ask, can you please clean up the Lego? Children think, no. Men say, please clean up the Lego. So the child doesn't think that no is an option. I'm not saying you should be a man. I'm just saying, there. Notice the difference in the way you frame, the way you ask it. Children sometimes actually feel that way. Like, you didn't tell me to do it. Sometimes parents even use the words, would you please? And the child doesn't. And then the parent says, I asked you to. And the child thinks, no, you didn't. You asked me if I would. So if the child's not chutzpahdik, they won't tell you that. But again, you have to ask yourself, what words did I use? And that's why I like giving children two things. I like giving them, I'd like you to do it now or within the next 5 minutes. And please come and tell me when you're finished. I want to see what a good job you did. When you tell a child that, you've made it very clear, I expect you to do it, and you're going to come back and tell me. So then there's, it's real. So you said it, and then you said it again, and the child's not doing it. So the first thing you have to check is, are they focused on doing something else? If they're in the middle of drawing a picture, so they're not with you. Sometimes parents are talking, and the kid's just not there. Chaim, are you listening? Uh-huh. Can you clean up your Lego? Uh-huh. Not even a second later, what you said just didn't register. It's like your husband in front of a computer. Don't talk to him now. He's not with you. If he's with you, then talk to him. You spoke to him when he wasn't with you. You didn't speak to him. And the same thing with a child. Children are very focused in other places, and you don't exist when they're zoned out. And it's not chutzpah. There's nothing wrong with the child. They don't deserve to be yelled at. They don't deserve to be... You can't be upset at them. They did nothing wrong. So, first thing is to say it again. The second thing is to question if you actually have the time. And that's where it comes back to what you were saying. If a child, when they ask for 2 seconds, or when they say, let me just finish this, are asking for control, there's nothing wrong with giving the child control. Unless it becomes a habit. And again, we're talking about up to age 6. The major problem is that do you have the time to follow up? What usually happens is the whole house is running and it's upside down, and about 2 hours later you remind yourself that they never dealt with the Lego and now they're sleeping. Now you look and you're going to have to bend down and pick up all that Lego. That's why it becomes challenging to give in and say, yeah, okay, he's playing now. So that's why I think the answer is yes, when possible. Usually it's not possible. Usually, if you're going to let them get away with it, what's going to end up happening is you're going to be the carbon of that. So when you ask a child, can you clean up? I want you to please clean up the Lego now. And a child says, Ima, I want to finish the drawing. So you have to decide. You can say, okay, finish the drawing. But then realize that if they don't remember to clean up the Lego, they did nothing wrong. You can't be upset at them. What you've just said, when you said you can finish the drawing, is you've said, you can finish the drawing, forget this conversation happened, and I won't be upset at you, because that's normal. But again, it's not. There's nothing wrong. There's no right answer here. It depends on the scenario. Sometimes you'll see that kids make it into habit. They see they're going to get away with it. Kids are very sharp. And sometimes the kids will specifically always try to push you off. And at that point, the right move, to my mind, is to go to the opposite extreme. Never let them. You have to take a block of time where you don't let them at all. Every time they ask for time, you say, no, why don't you do that after you do what we just discussed? After you see that you've broken that habit, then you could go back to deciding when yes and when no. But that's at a later age. I don't think kids are going to do that before the age of 6. Another point to remember is that children lose focus in a split second. That means, could be they're cleaning up the Lego, and they saw a bird chirping. So they went to the window and they watched the bird chirping. The Lego disappeared. It never happened. You never asked. They're not bad children. They don't deserve to be yelled at. They're 100% fine. The child was cleaning up the Lego, and you called them and asked them, do you want soup? And the child looked up and said, no. And you said, but you like soup. It's the soup you like. I made it for you. And the child said, well, I don't feel like having soup. You had a 3-second conversation, 4-second conversation, and then they went back to drawing. They did nothing wrong. That's 100% normal. Children lose focus quicker than adults. Yeah, we also lose focus, right? Where are my keys? And there's nothing wrong. It's completely normal. You have to be patient. The child did nothing wrong. And that's why sometimes if we want to accomplish something, we have to make sure the child started. Meaning, I ask the child to clean up the Lego, and the child says, in a second, Mom, I want you to call me when you start. Not only tell me when you're done. And then, at least in your mind, you have this like registered, are they telling you they started? So we discussed the importance of also defining. What do I want from you? We discussed the idea of specific areas. No, we didn't. You tell your children, I want you all to clean the living room floor. In utopia, that might work. In real life, you clean that. No, you clean that. You're going to get nowhere. What I sometimes do is I take a broom or a magaf, I collect the toys into four piles, and I say, you're responsible for this, you're responsible for that, you're responsible for that, you're responsible for that. And the kids love it. It's amazing to see. It's defined. I know what I'm supposed to do, and there's also satisfaction. I know when I'm done. When you tell a child, clean up the room, they know that chances are that when they're done, they're going to get negative feedback. How would you like to clean up a room when you know that when you finished, your mom's going to walk in and say, well, why don't you do that? Why don't you do that? When was the last time your kids did what you asked them and you walked in and said, that was great? When was the last time you gave them something to do that was so defined that they can actually succeed at it? So to tell a child, please clean up your room, and then you're going to walk in and be the nasty police woman who's going to say, hey, what about that shirt? That sock doesn't belong in the hamper? And then you're going to be frustrated with them. Well, what'd you do to the kid? So when you define things for the kids, then you're also giving them something they can succeed at. We want kids to succeed. So by defining it, by saying, I want you to clean up the Lego and call me. And then when you come in, your first reaction should be, that's amazing. Wow, you cleaned up the Lego. Good for you. Okay, then I can move on to thinking about, do you think we could find a few more pieces that we didn't accomplish? But again, what's the order? I know this isn't the way any house works, right? But that's the way we want to work. That's the way we would want our parents to work with us. And if we want our kids to be excited about helping, we have to find ways to be positive about what they're doing. There are all kinds of shitot that I know nothing about. Giving stickers, giving prizes. We're going to discuss rewards, but I don't know how to work with any of these as shitot. There are parents that it works for. There are people that swear by it. They have sticker charts and all these different types of things. Okay, I don't know how to work that. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying it's bad. I don't believe in it, but other people can make it work. You're welcome to go to someone else's class or listen to someone else. And I'm not saying it doesn't work. I don't understand the system, but I've seen people that it works for. I'm not saying not to reward. We're going to get to that probably at a later date, how important reward is and how we all function better with reward. But that's not what I'm talking about. There are shitot about rewards. Well, I don't know those shitot. So you tried everything we just said and it didn't work. You came home, you asked your kids, can you clean up the Lego? You were very good. You said, I want you to clean up this area of Lego. Tell me when you start. The kid said, they're starting. Two Legos and they stopped. Or they didn't even start. And it's not working. It's not working. They don't even start. So you asked the kid to clean up the Lego and they didn't. So you have to analyze now one of three things. What's going on here? Why is it that every time I'm talking, we're not getting anywhere? Are they ignoring me? There are three possible scenarios. Ignoring me, forgetting what I asked, or are they postponing? If they're just postponing and then they forget, or they forget, so then you just have to change the habit. But if they're ignoring you, then you have to deal. That's a different question. I think we're going to shift the questions. And we'll pick up here maybe next time. Before we shift the questions, when is next time? Because we said we'd meet the Tuesday of Shabbos Mevarchim, and next time is Rosh Hashanah, which is on Sunday, Monday. No, Monday, Tuesday, Sunday, Monday, Thursday, Friday. Thursday, Friday, Shabbos. So we don't want to meet Tuesday. Thursday is Rosh Hashanah, I assume. So the question is, I was open to moving it a week earlier, the week before Rosh Hashanah, not the week up. Because I said to make tshuva, the question is, do we want to meet? I don't know. What do people want? Okay. What, a week before? Yeah, the week before? Because I think otherwise you start getting into the mode of cooking and whatever, Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. So that was why I didn't want to postpone this week, because I figured people would prefer the week before Rosh Hashanah. Okay, so it's not the week of Rosh Hashanah? Zachem will meet the week before Rosh Hashanah. Okay, so are there questions on what we've been discussing?
You didn't finish the story part though, right? Am I missing something?
I didn't get feedback that people wanted me to elaborate on stories. I asked and there was silence.
No, because then someone else asked the question, so I just wanted to be sure I didn't miss it.
You didn't miss it. I need to know if you want me to come back to it. I think it's a tool which people have to develop. When you know how to tell a story, how many people want us to spend another 10 minutes next time on how to tell a story?
I'm sure.
Yeah? Oh, okay. Say that.
I think just the question.
No. I asked before the question. I asked if people want to spend more time on it.
I feel like no one responded.
Okay, fine. Okay. So we started dealing with what are the steps you take when your child is not listening. We'll continue with that Bezachim down the road. Did we discuss playing with toys on Shabbat and teaching Muktzah? We didn't discuss that yet, right? At what age is it appropriate? Okay, so in a nutshell, children can understand, maybe we'll separate the recordings.